Notice here that psychic energy has for its pivot a symbol. But however many symbols there are, all of those symbols form the structure of the self. So that there is like an effective therapy in terms of knowledge, which leads you to the symbols. But then there's an exponential therapeia that goes beyond that and raises knowledge to wisdom when one goes to the self. And it goes to the self. It's not that you find something there, but you experience that this is where it all happens, all in fact happens. The self wears symbols just like we would wear jewelry. And it is royal, always royal. Self is indeed royal. And it's always a self and always in sync with its hidden natural complement. Why is nature in the self hidden? In the self, it's not hidden. But in the psychic energy, which is expressive of the self, it is hidden. So that as long as you remain in the magic realm, as long as you remain in the transformational process of psychic energy, nature is hidden. When you are able to accept the presence of the self, nature becomes quite real, quite visible. In fact, how is the saying? In bare attention, one sees exactly what is there. Let me give you a quotation. The central magical hymn from The Secret of the Golden Flower. Self-experience. Four words crystallize the spirit in the place of power. In the sixth month, the white snow is suddenly seen to fly. At the third watch, the disk of the sun sends out shining rays. On the water blows the wind of gentleness. Wandering in heaven, one eats the spirit power of the receptive. And the deeper secret within the secret, the land that is nowhere, that is the true home. Now you can see from what I have said, you can understand this magic spell in The Secret of the Golden Flower, I would think, quite readily. There are two illustrations in The Secret of the Golden Flower, one on page 51 and one on page 63. And I put a marker here in here for you. Those illustrations appear in Mr. Hall's magnum opus of his own personal technique, Self-Unfoldment by Disciplines of Realization. Mr. Hall's book on self-unfoldment has those same illustrations from The Secret of the Golden Flower. They occur opposite page 139 and opposite page 163. So those illustrations from The Secret of the Golden Flower occur in here. Mr. Hall did the first edition of Self-Unfoldment in 1940, and I did 12 lectures on this 9 years ago at PRS, and somewhere around we have the tapes of that. Let me finish this up for you. This is powerful. In this expressive mode, the amulet quality becomes a talisman quality, radiating out the collected energy as light. And I put light in quotation marks, as the traditional word has it. That is to say, coming into presence of the deep self, the natural experience that's there is to come out radiant. Not to stay there. No, there's no there to stay. So that the experience of that presence includes within it the quality of radiance coming out as light. The traditional saying is that one wears a garment of light. Henri Corbin wrote a beautiful book on the man of light in Iranian Sufism that was published in the Bollingen series. It's the way in which the genius of high medieval Persian wisdom understood this, based on Avicenna's visionary recital cycle. In the West, the phrase that was always used is fiat lux, make light. Nature is a first world, culture a second with ritual and myth. The self on the symbolic horizon is a third, thrice great as Hermes. The person, the emergence of the person, is a fourth world. In fact, one might almost say a mysterious fourth. The person is the fourth world. It's like a whole different world. The world of culture is a different world from nature. The world of the self is quite distinctly different from nature or culture. And the realm of the person is quite different. But yet the, I used yet, I crossed but out, yet the objectivity would be skewed here, since nature as a transformational media is not in itself a stability. If you can characterize nature, it's characterized as change, not as a stability. Where is the first stability? The first stability is in the mask. It's in the ritual comportment which makes the mask. Since yet the objectivity would be skewed here, since nature as a transformational media is not a stability. Its world is really stable only in what we can call, have called, do call, the spirit. Put brusquely, spirit is the stability in the natural world order. But to know this, it takes real science to know that that is so. That's to come. That's a long way. That's at the end of this second year. For now, we must focus on this mandala. And then I've drawn here a mandala, which has a circle with a cross in it, equal arm cross. On the inner side of the circle, at the top, I have nature. And clockwise, in the 3 o'clock position, I have myth. In the 6 o'clock position, I have magic. In the 9 o'clock position, I have history. Nature, myth, magic, and history. Then in the angles of the quaternary, in the upper right hand, I have ritual. In the lower right hand, symbol. In the lower left hand, I have art. In the upper right hand, I have science. And then write this. You can make copies for yourself later. The four cardinal designations form the complete process flow of the four transformational media. The four intermediate designations are the quaternary of object which express, I've written it here, I guess in a little clumsy way, what it expresses is life. Life. What is really objective is life. Life is really objective. Life is not transitory, as we suppose, within a permanent nature. Nature is transitory within a very permanent life. Life in its actuality does not die. It never has died. So what's permanent in this universe is life. And what's transitory are the natural matrix by which it expresses itself initially. Nature is as transitory as cultures. The self is as real as you ever want anything to be. So that while moving clockwise, we can observe magic as the quintessence, the fifth essence, as Hermetic tradition or Taoist tradition in the five-phase energy cycle, which is the Tao Te Ching, chapter 42, records it. So if you move in a clockwise way, you have nature, ritual, myth, symbol, magic. Magic is the quintessence. It's the fifth essence. It's literally the fifth essence. Why? Because in the ancient teaching of this tradition, the quintessence was the key. It wasn't so much the center. The symbolic self was always the center. But the quintessence was the key that unlocked the center. That's the way it was taught in ancient times. We have yet to consider the three yet to come, science, history, and art, which build the expressive form of personal civilization in complement to tribal culture, which uses ritual, myth, and symbol. Thus, magic is a bridge between two great orders of our experience. And nature also eventually is a bridge between these two great orders of experience. With magic, visible conscious order based on the symbolic self begins to displace nature as the working basis of life. A magician is feared by the tribe. Magic can stop food production or can be made to increase it. Both ways, magic changes what before was a natural concourse. How does magic do this? Because it polarizes the world. It polarizes the world. So that I haven't written it down here, but there's a perilous element in consciousness. And the symbol for it is always the double-edged sword. The same consciousness that allows for discrimination also can kill. What does it kill? It kills the natural order that organically is there. If we knew how powerful knowing insight would be, we would be like gentlemen around Cyrano de Bergerac and not pull out our swords so often. Because every time we see something, definitely we cut up the natural order. We have to be very careful to understand that it isn't really cut up. I'll give you a little vignette about just this point from Taoist lore, from ancient Chinese lore, and then we'll take a break. One of the great Han emperors, Han Wu Ti, was used to having sacrifices made where they carved up the water buffalo. And he heard about this famous Taoist butcher who was the best at carving up the sacrificial buffalo. And so he had him brought before the court and to show his stuff. And he went through it, and it was just like magic. It was quick, it was pure, it was fast. And he asked him, he said, how is it that you can do this so fast? And everyone else takes so much time, it almost took you no time at all. And the old Taoist butcher said, well, other men cut the muscles and the gristle and the bone. My knife slips in between all of that. I slip in the spaces in between. And thus, while other butchers have to sharpen their knife after every water buffalo that they sacrifice and cut up. I've used this knife for 50 years and I've never sharpened it once because I don't touch anything when I cut. It's like that. Let's take a break. Sorry to be so much like a schoolmarm sometimes. Just have it. Like I said to you this morning, I'm trying to pack enough into this particular program so that when versions of it are used in amplified conditions that they'll work. One of the amplified conditions that I could see is that these eight parts will be a good matrix for the first eight grades in education, first through eighth grade. And that then repeating two of the sections together would be the equivalent of the modern high school. And then taking the course on a one-on-one basis, a quarter for each subject, so it's a two-year course, would be equivalent to the two-year college program. That is to say, this structure will carry as much meaning as you can feed it. It's a symbolic structure. It will carry, in fact, as much meaning as any population of people wish to feed it. So that it's always different. Some of you who have been through this before can recognize and see that it's never the same. Though the structure is the same, the content is always just similar, and occasionally there are deja vu experiences, but by and large, let's turn that off, it's fresh. One reason why I have never written it down in detail is because teaching it should be spontaneous and should be fresh. The only reason I'm beginning to write it down now is to make a gift of the structure. It's not going to be anything that's going to be copyrighted. As far as I'm concerned, it's like the table of elements in physics. It is a universal structure. I didn't invent it. The only thing I did was to pull out of tradition the structure which can work in our own situation. And it had to be done because the ethnocentric forms which surrounded the traditional wisdom were just not... They're not workable for interstellar man. You can't talk about the experience of God as a silence in the desert when you've never maybe grew up in a place where there are no deserts. So it had to be changed. It had to be universalized. So part of the material that you're doing, like these assignments with alchemical studies, your study groups of reading these sections, it doesn't matter how you do it. However you choose to do it, that's the right way. What I learned from this is by seeing how much of it was able to be done, not how much of this material you covered, but how much you were able to do. What's really successful is when it all works, when all of these groups in their right sequence are able to present something. When I first started this kind of a technique, I started in 1970 with the mythology section, which at that time was a big puzzle for me. It was a real problem. 70 to 73, I had all kinds of problems with the mythology. And part of the difficulty was I did not know how structurally important ritual was. I mean, I understood it intellectually, but I hadn't been slapped hard enough yet to know that you can't talk about myth without having done ritual. And at that time, I used the Book of Hopi by Frank Waters. And I used to try to assign the Book of Hopi to the students. The student population at that time ran between 70 and 120. And try to get groups within that population to research and deliver in little skit forms the ritual year, the ritual cycle on which the Hopi mythology was based, and then have the rest of the group fill in the mythology on the basis of the rituals being presented in brief and in skit form. And I worked with this for 3 years before I could even have it done once. And you would think that it's such a simple thing to do, but it isn't simple at all. For us to go back to a primordial form is really difficult because everything gets in our way. It's like our ego does not want us to know that there are really primordial forms of operating which don't need the permission of the ego to work. And the ego becomes a self-saboteur. I don't want to sound too tough or mysterious, but it's just that simple. And one has to get around this self-sabotaging. Generally, self-sabotaging is unconscious in the form of laziness, sloth, lack of interest, boredom, like that. And it's only when you challenge it directly that the real set comes out, and you see the kind of viciousness of which the inflated ego is capable of. You never know how vicious they are until you try to take the money away from the banks. And then you see how vicious they are. It's just like that. So that in the Hermetic tradition, the messenger is always a trickster. And the trickster always has a bit of the thief. The hat that classical Greeks always put on Odysseus was the hat that is identified with Hermes the thief. You know, Hermes, when he was a little boy, the first thing that he did was steal the cattle of Apollo. And when Apollo caught him, he said, "Well, you caught me. But I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll make this little musical instrument for you." And he gave Apollo the first lyre. And Apollo found him so lovable that he sort of adopted him as his foster father. That's the myth of this kind of a figure. Sometimes you have to activate the trickster element in yourself to subvert the tyrannical ego in yourself to get something done in terms of being able to return back to primal modes of being. You have to somehow get back to being able to have raw experience so that it isn't pre-digested and pre-packaged by your worldly self. And in our time, in our age, the late 20th century, the mode which is most difficult to deal with is time. It isn't goods, but it's time. And so, literally, you have to learn how to steal time for yourself, from your worldly self. Now, with alchemical studies, we've got those five sections, but there are two people that are not on any of these sections, Toshi and Linda. Did you?
I'm Lois.
Lois's? Which is what? Mercurius? Don and Lois?
Don and Lois.
Okay, so you're going to be on, so the fourth part of this book, and you're going to work with them. I want you people to work together. Do it by phone if you have to, or do it here, but work together. Don't do it separately. Make a hunting party out of it. Work together. Because, as I said this morning, the five parts of this book are the five facets of Jung's deepest self. And he was as slippery as they come. Some of you have read Miguel Serrano's account of seeing Jung just 2 days before he died at age 86. And he was wearing that conical wizard's cap and a Japanese kimono and carrying Desjardins' Phenomenon of Man, and he had his pipe with sparks coming out of it, pacing the room in heavy boots 2 days before he died. His eyes were flashing. Do you know where that conical hat comes from that has the stars and the crescent moon and that? Michael Scott. Michael Scott, who was the court magician for, you knew it from me? I mentioned it before, yeah. Back in the early 1200s, he was the first Western magus. Friedrich Hohenstaufen, who was tremendous. He was the portraits of him are always the not just a king, but a king of kings. He was an emperor, and he had a pet falcon that he used to always carry with him, and a big fur hat, and his court magician, Michael Scott, with a conical cap and everything. This was an old Arabian magus costume, which this wild Irishman appropriated for himself. More to come. Toshi, which of these five sections? Did you get a chance to think about it? Tree of Life, good. So that's with Jennifer and Chris and Ed and Walter. So the five of you can get together. You can do this in any way that you want. You can portion it out, or you can all do it together. Well, however you do it is fine. What I'm interested in is to see that it happens. Whatever form it is up to you. For me, that it happens is the important thing. The second piece of business is I want you to select something that you read in. It's called here a year-long text. Something that you read in all year. It's like setting a common background to the whole range of the year's studies and inquiry. It's like a bedside companion, if you will. And it's enough if you just read a page a night, if you read it every night. The whole object of this year-long text is to give you a companion. And the two companions, the choices here, are between Virgil and Chaucer. Virgil's Aeneid or Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. Either one of them will do. Chaucer is the friend of man, and Virgil is the maker of world visions. So it depends on what altitude. Virgil would be a very high rocky path through the passes, and Chaucer would be a ride through the forest. It's like that. Either way works. So choose one of those two. Get yourself a copy. You can get used copies of these things for, I don't know, a couple bucks. And just keep it with you. Keep it by your side. And read in it frequently to get the flavor of it. Because both the Aeneid and the Canterbury Tales are long conscious journeys. Don't be fooled by Chaucer having written in, quote, medieval times. He's highly conscious. Highly conscious. If you look at the English language before Chaucer and the English language after Chaucer, you see how important he was. He literally took a language and raised it up to a height where you could express symbolic and personal values, which had been unconscious before him. He's a very great figure. Without Chaucer, there would have been no Shakespeare. Shakespeare builds on Chaucer. Okay, so we've got all that done. Did you get, I guess all of you that wanted got copies of this. If some of you want, after the session, well, you can make copies for yourself. I want to talk just for a few minutes about the secret of the golden flower. at the very end of The Secret of the Golden Flower, in his conclusion, Jung puts in an appendage here on examples of European mandalas. Now he said, the aim of my commentary is the effort to build a bridge of psychological understanding between East and West. Why is it between East and West? He's not just speaking of East and West geographically, but he's speaking with the recognition that the East is the unconscious of the West, just like the West is the unconscious of the East. And that a planetary civilization, which is emerging now, has a really basic monumental strategic task. We have to understand each other. And just like there are groups like this everywhere in the West, understanding the East, there are groups like this everywhere in China and Japan talking about mathematics and engineering and technology. For them to understand that is really esoteric, just like for us to understand some of the insights, psychological insights, like in The Secret of the Golden Flower. There's a real exchange. But Jung cautions us not to give up one for the other. It's not a question of giving one up for the other. It's a question of both halves of the world bringing all of it to consciousness. We're going to need everything that we have. We're going to need everything. One of the things about the kind of challenge that faces us is you have to meet it with 100% of your effort. Whatever you hold back, it's by that much that you fail. These are called spiritual tests. And in a spiritual test, whatever you have, you use. You don't leave anything left, because that's the margin of failure, whatever you have left. This is summed up in the English word commitment. There are certain challenges that the commitment is 100%. That's what we're facing now. At the end of the conclusion, he has a little section on mandalas. Now, the mandalas are extremely important, and Mr. Hall's great book on mandalas will be coming out in about 3 months or so. And in discussing with him of how to best to handle this, we're going to have the editor of his book, Basil Jenkins, give a lecture on a Sunday at PRS in April. And then in June, I'll give a Sunday lecture at PRS on the use of mandalas, both in their Tibetan or Asian form and in their Western Jungian form, with an emphasis more on the way in which Mr. Hall has developed things. Mr. Hall and Jung are very close, but in some ways Mr. Hall is more fearlessly open than Jung is. Jung always kept the monocle of Herr Professor Doctor on his eyes, and Mr. Hall has looked with no intervening frame of reference. Occasionally Jung would take off his glasses for friends. But Mr. Hall's done that publicly for 70 years. And there's a certain kind of mobility that comes with that. And so I'm going to, it'll be June 25th of 1989. And I'll give that lecture on mandalas. So some of the work that we're doing now, you'll see a summation of that in late June. That incidentally will be Marie Hall's 85th birthday that day. Okay, that's for that. To help you get into A Midsummer Night's Dream, I want to give you a poem which appears at the end of A Midsummer Night's Dream. And I'm going to juxtapose that poem with the Taoist magical poem in Secret of the Golden Flower. In The Secret of the Golden Flower, the symbols, because they're in the Chinese East Asian tradition, are quite open. In Shakespeare, the symbols are there, but they're hidden. They're occult. They're occult because someone naively reading Shakespeare thinks that he's talking about images when he's giving you very powerful symbols, symbols of the self. So here it is. Here's the East Asian poetry, and then I'll give you the Shakespearean. Four words crystallize the spirit in the place of power. In the sixth month, the white snow is suddenly seen to fly. At the third watch, the disk of the sun sends out shining rays. On the water blows the wind of gentleness. Wandering in heaven, one eats the spirit power of the receptive. And the deeper secret, within the secret, the land that is nowhere, that is the true home. And then Shakespeare, this is Oberon's song at the end of Midsummer Night's Dream. Through the house give glimmering light, by the dead in drowsy fire. Every elf and fairy sprite hop as light as bird from briar. And this ditty after me, sing and dance it trippingly. Now until the break of day, through this house each fairy stray, to the best bride bed will we, which by us shall blessed be, and the issue there create, ever shall be fortunate. So shall all the couples three ever true and loving be, and the blots of nature's hand shall not in their issue stand. Never mole, hair, lip, nor scar, nor mark prodigious such as are, despised in nativity, shall upon their children be. With this field do consecrate, every fairy take his gate, and each several chamber bless through this palace with sweet peace, and the owner of it blessed ever shall in safety rest. Trip away, make no stay, meet me all by break of day. And the king of the fairy realm gives that blessing to the house. So get your Shakespeare. Now we have a few things that have been brought in. We have one brave soul who has reluctantly brought something rather large to show. Do you need some help in getting it out?
Oh, I got it out already.
Have you got it out? Do you need some help holding it up?
No, not yet.
Okay, let's start with Dolores.
I won't show my talisman yet, but I just want to tell my story. I live up in the hills up of Coldwater, and there's a lot of nature there. And I, well, before about a year and a half ago, I took these long hour walks, the roads and so forth. And right above to it, and I think, you know, these me. But as I started walking, I'd go to the vistas, and soon I could just stand there with my hands out, and the hawks would just come wherever they were. I mean, I thought that this happened, and they'd circle over me. And this sort of saga or odyssey, whatever you call it, lasted about 6 months. And as I got into it, I became obsessed with this. I mean, I lived to go on my walks to see these hawks. And then one day when I was coming back, I saw this red-tailed hawk on the side of the road, dead. And I don't know what happened to me. I looked at it and I thought it was my hawk. And I just went home and I plopped on the bed and I just sobbed and sobbed. And if someone had asked me, I mean, why are you sobbing like this? I wouldn't have been able to tell them, because it was the deepest sobs I've ever heard come out of me. And it was like, I don't know, I was sobbing for the whole world. I don't know what it was, but I got up and I went back out. And I put flowers over the hawk and said a little prayer. And then it seemed like after this experience, everything changed. I was coming down from the hill one time, and this big black buzzard hawk, I had seen him on the antenna, and I had waved. He was about maybe a mile away, and I just, you know, waved to him. And as I came down the hill toward my house, he swooped in front of me, and he was, I mean, this close, and my eyes, I mean, we just looked into each other's eyes, and I thought, wow, you know, and I still didn't know. I had to more or less sit down last night and write this all out to sort of follow this whole experience. And then after this happened, I felt, what's happening? Is someone trying to tell me something? And so a friend called and said, oh, there's Bearheart, Grandfather Bearheart is going to be speaking about American Indian ceremonies, and there's going to be a sweat lodge. I feel you should go. And so I had never been to that. I never had studied Indian lore, and I went. And the whole talk was about the Indians and how they related to, well, the hawks, the eagles, and they felt it was a spirit talking to them. And so I said, well, gee, I'm having these strange experiences. What should I do? Grandfather said, well, next time you go for your walk and you know the hawk's around, draw a circle, step inside and put some sage or some, you know, spice and say a little prayer. So I can't believe it, but I did this. And so then to this one place where I'd walk up on the vista, there must have been several hawks that I always watched, because I guess they were, that was their nest. And then this man came up with his German Shepherd dog, and it was near the Kjoy Towers, if anyone knows where that is. It's really high up there. And so this fellow told his dog to go to me, and I started coming, and then I stood and I said, does this dog bite? And he said, you know, you've been walking on this private road for a long time. I've been watching you, and I don't like it, and I want you to stop. And I said, but I'm your neighbor. All I want to do is come here and watch the hawks. And he said, well, I can't be responsible for what my dog does. And so I left, and all the way I kept thinking, why? You know, why did you do this to me? I was talking to the spirit speak. You know how much I love watching those hawks. I kept thinking about it all day long. And so the next day I decided I'd change my way. I'd go to the other hill. And I did, and I kept looking for the hawks, and no hawks, you know, and I thought, oh, they've forsaken me. And then as I got to the very top, I went around the bend, and there the hawk was sitting on a telephone pole, waiting for me. And he just sat there, and the words in my head were, the Spirit goes with you no matter where you go. And I thought, I just looked at the hawk for about 5 minutes, and then he flew away. And then I thought, well, is this a dream? Is this, I mean, what is all this about? Is this really happening to me? And then it seemed like I had to be assured several other times, because I went to Stamford to visit my daughter, and the same thing happened when I went up in the hills walking. This big black buzzard hawk swooped down in front of me and waited on the tree, and I went up to him and talked, well, communicated with him. And then I went to Swami Vedatari's retreat in the desert for a week to meditate through